In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Dr. Spencer Nadolski, obesity and lipid specialist. Dr. Spencer and I speak about obesity drugs, how they function, and lifestyle practices alongside of them. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Dr. Spencer, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much, and now on to my conversation with Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Spencer Nadolski, obesity and lipid specialist, and he has a new clinical service called Vineyard. I'm excited to hear all about it. Spencer, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's my absolute pleasure. And before we dive into all the things that you do so wonderfully with your clients and with your clinical service with, I'd love to hear just more about you and how you got to where you are today and what you do today.
Yeah, so I grew up in a somewhat of an academic and athletic family. My dad was a biology teacher and a wrestling coach, and my mom was an elementary school teacher. And so, growing up through life, we kind of focused a lot on science and we were into exercise. My dad had a key to the weight room at the high schools and he was the coach. So we'd go and even work out at a young age. And basically throughout high school, I mean, I knew I kind of wanted to be a doctor, didn't know what type, but then went through college. I was doing pretty well at sports. I wrestled in college, played some football too, but in order to get good at those sports, I use a lot of science and obviously hard work to get better by using exercise and nutrition science to get better. And then when I went to med school, it was like, all right, what am I going to do? And I've kind of gravitated towards like endocrinology and weight loss. And people are like, oh, you should do ortho because you're a big, strong guy. That's kind of it's one of those things that people think of when you think of, you know, big strong guys go to ortho, kind of a stereotype, so to speak. And I didn't like it. I went and shadowed some doctor. I was like, I don't like this, but I really liked helping people lose weight and kind of getting them better. So then you do residency. I actually ended up in family medicine because it was the idea was to get people a little bit earlier before they would need one of these kind of end stage disease doctors, like a cardiologist or an endocrinologist, to try to prevent it in the first place. And then at that time doing family medicine, it was one of those things like, the system's archaic. I don't like the way that the way medicine's being practiced. So that's what got me into kind of innovative ways of delivering medicine and kind of got me into telemedicine. And back in the day, there was a big initial pushes to do fitness online. And it thought, well, we could do medicine online too, and kind of combine it, fitness, medicine, nutrition, online. So that's kind of where it brought me to today. And I've had a few ventures where I've done those types of things and done pretty well.
Very cool. I love it. And yeah, I love the message that you're spreading online. And on Instagram primarily is where I follow your content. And specifically one of your more recent posts was kind of titled somewhere along the lines of, most people either think it's diet and exercise or drugs and surgery. And then Your tagline below is like, realize that it can be a combination or, you know, a variation of both. And thought that was brilliant. I'd love to hear you explain a little bit what prompted you to put it in that way.
Yeah. So basically diet and exercise are always kind of the base of all, like, you know, actually chronic disease treatment and prevention. My brother and I wrote a blog article. It might have been 10 years ago now. It's been a while. But basically, everybody says, oh, doctors are just chills and whatever. They just want to prescribe medicine. But like when you look at the guidelines written from the medical organizations, they say, you know, lifestyle is first line. And it should be. Now the issue is that some people, it's just not enough. Or I'd say a lot of people, it's not enough. And we can get into why that is, but it's not one or the other. So you always have the base component of the diet and exercise guidelines and recommendations. Whether people are doing it or not is another story. The medicines for weight loss should help facilitate those things though. If they're struggling, Physical, when you have a lot of weight to lose, physical activity can be difficult. It's miserable. So then adding the medicine can help people lose weight, feel better. So then they can start being physically active. Some people have struggles staying away from whatever the super hyper palatable, yummy, easily overeaten foods with high calories. And despite they're like, yeah, I should probably eat more protein and vegetables and lower calorie foods, but it's like they're driven and biologically. So that's where the medicine jumps in and helps them. So it's not like you go, forget about diet, just take the medicine. The medicine should actually help facilitate it. And so, but no matter what, those diet and exercise recommendations are always the base of that pyramid, so to speak.
I love that, and I truly think like we don't have to pick one camp or the other. And if we address obesity in the right way, as you do so beautifully, with maybe perhaps a combination of both initially, at least, it can be a really good some synergy, I guess. But maybe for people listening that are not that familiar with obesity drugs, maybe you can just explain the basic fundamental mechanism of how they work.
Yeah. So these medicines work essentially by helping people eat fewer calories. And the way they do that is through receptors in the brain that modulate or have an effect on appetite drive. Now, appetite can include a lot. It's, a drive to eat, and there can be multiple reasons for why people eat. But hunger, of course, if you're hungrier, you're going to eat more. If you crave certain foods, despite not being hungry, you're going to eat more. So they help with that. And there's also this concept called food noise. It's just thinking about food, not specific foods, just thinking about food in general, even when you're not hungry and not craving things. And they seem to help with that as well. And that's a kind of a newer concept that's come to light because of these medicines. People are like, wow, I don't think about food all day now because of these medicines. So a lot of people at first were like, oh, these are fat burners. They're like, they're just melting fat pe off of people when they take the medicines. No, they specifically work through a calorie reduction, but the downstream effect is it helps with the why people are eating more than they should for weight loss anyway. In the future, there's some drugs down the pipeline where that will have an effect on metabolic rate, basal metabolic rate, resting metabolic rate. They're not out yet, but there will be a component where we may be able to raise people's metabolism and increase the energy expenditure part of it. But for now, they work primarily on the energy in part. So that's kind of the gist. There's a lot of research on the different receptors in the brain that they're helping and how, and they do these animal models where they delete those parts, they block these parts of the brain and then see if it actually helps people eat the mice or whatever animal they're working with eat less. So that's kind of how they figure it out, the little molecular mechanisms in the brain. But in general, yeah, they just help people eat fewer calories.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for that explanation. And if you went further with that in some of your content as well, saying that they can even potentially help in some way, quote unquote, fix someone's relationship with food, is that food noise what you meant by that?
Yeah. So if you're always thinking about food, and it's not even just like how much you're gonna eat, but that's part of it. It's like when you're gonna eat, just thinking about food, just all these different thoughts about food, it can make you anxious and makes you have a bad relationship with food. Or if you have high cravings for specific foods and you're just like, I know I should do this, but it's like the chips are just there. If you dampen those feelings, you all of a sudden can go, all right, I feel comfortable around food. I don't have to think about it all the time. I'll just do what I know I should do. And so it makes them decreases the anxiety. It makes them feel better about food. And people, that's what they report. Just a better relationship with food, not thinking about it all the time. That's right.
Okay, and so like backtracking on that further, how do you think, or from your observation as well, that whole always thinking about food and obesity in general even comes into existence?
Yeah, I mean the In general, it's this, well, it's thought to be mostly from our environment. I mean, we have these genetics that are underlying, but like what's changed mostly is our environment and these foods that are probably been engineered in ways that bypass our normal satiety signals in our brain. So like, back in however many decades ago, we'd eat the foods that were around us. You didn't need to necessarily think about portions and whatever, and we just eat till we're full and that's it. So now they engineer foods that are surrounding us and we're just eating till we're full and until we're content. If they're bypassing some of those usual signals in our brain, pathways in our brain, then all of a sudden you're just eating more of them. And they're looking into exactly why that happens, but the gist is we eat more of them, more calories, et cetera. So that's how it kind of develops in the first place. Now the genetics come into play, whereas even back, say, decades and centuries ago, people with the highest genetic propensity still would be heavier back then. It's just heavier, like shifted over a bit. So now those people that were heavier back then, that who we'd consider maybe even, just slightly overweight now in some cases, they're the ones developing very high amounts of obesity because they're genetically, predisposed to it. But now they're in this environment where they're eating much, much, much more, and those foods are really bypassing the pathways in our brain. So that's the gist of it. Lots of research being done of what to do about it. We'll see where they get, but yeah, that's the gist.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I would love to give you a little bit of like an example client and what you slash your clinic would do with that kind of person. So let's say we do have someone, a female, maybe 5'2", 180, 190 pounds, rather physically inactive, and as you said, she's mostly reporting like thinking about food all day long. She's tried various diets, didn't quote unquote work. What would be your action plan with her long term?
Tell me, what's the case?
Well, I mean, reducing her body fat percentage, but how do you go about it in terms of your GLP-1 agonists or in terms of treatment plan when it comes to diet and exercise as well?
So I mean, like it depends on the person. So if somebody comes in, and they just have like, it depends on how much weight that I think that they need to lose and if they need to lose it for clinical purposes. So
Well, let's
let's
say
say,
as she was like 180 pounds, as I mentioned, or so, let's say her ideal or good normal body weight for her would be somewhere between 130, 140 pounds, maybe.
So let's say like I don't know what the BMI would be. Let's say they're like 5'2" or something like that. So in these cases, let's say they come in going like, I've tried everything. I've done calories and macros. I've had coaches. I've done keto. I've done XYZ. I've done all the different exercise plans. I am working out right now. I'm lifting a few times a week, blah, 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 blah. And they're still at that weight. That's where I'd go like, look, let's not try another diet and exercise plan. Let's talk to you. Are you interested in one of these medicines? They go, oh, I don't know. I don't know. Does my insurance approve it? Whatever. Let's say their insurance covers it. Everything's good there. That's where I would go. I go, look, you've done everything. Now, let's say they haven't done anything, which is rare now when I see them. When I see them, they've already done lots of things, but it's possible that, and let's say they've never, ever really tried anything. You could go, like, look, you can try one of these medicines, but, we could try to give it a good structured, exercise, diet, lifestyle plan, just see how you do. When you look at the trials, a small proportion of people on the placebo will achieve very high amounts of weight loss. So it's possible that they'll do well. So you can offer it. It really depends if they come in having done things in the past, like nonstop, it would be somewhat of a insult to be like, all right, let's do those things again to see what happens. So that's where I'd offer like a GLP-1, or there are other medicines besides GLP-1, but everybody wants a GLP-1 because they work so much better than the older ones. But yeah, that's the gist.
Gotcha. Okay. And then like in terms of long time, so what Again, in our example client, so she now starts lifting. She now starts eating in a calorie deficit, actually, and taking some of these GLP-1 agonizers. What kind of duration are we talking about? Like, how long are you expecting for her to take to lose those 50 pounds-ish? And then how do you transition her off of it if you do that?
Yeah, so the paradigm now is thinking of this as more of like a chronic disease or condition, whatever you want to say. The doctors will say disease, similar to blood pressure. If they have high blood pressure, keep them on the medicine. If you take it off, their blood pressure might go back up. Not everybody. So most people who start these things will likely have to stay on them indefinitely, at least some form. You could titrate, take the dose down, space it out to see if they do all right. Other people just have to stay on the max dose. In general, they lose around, a half a percent to 1 or so% of their weight per week, at least in the beginning, and it starts slowing down later. So like 180 pounds, 1%, it's going to be around, about 1.5 to 2 pounds a week. Something, if she's a low responder, it's going to be like 1 pound a week. So we're looking at, somewhere around a year to a 72 weeks is one of it's 68 weeks or 72 weeks with the trials that they've had, and they've extended them a little bit longer, and they slowly start eking out a little bit more weight loss as it keeps going on, up to like 88 weeks or so. But yeah, in general, it's going to be at least a year till they probably lose most and they start plateauing, and then whether they should come off. Again, most people will have to stay on, but there's some people that if they want to try to come off, I help them wean it off. I don't bring it up. It causes a lot of anxiety, so I let the patient say like, "Hey, I want to try to come off," and I'm like, "Okay, well, we can try it." Give them their best shot. So that's usually how we do it.
Okay, great. Thank you for talking us through that example. And some other things that I hear people talk about or see people postulating on is like GLP-1 for things like PCOS, or on the other side, things like more longevity purposes and so on. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think there's certainly an effect on some of these other conditions that, the PCOS is related to weight, but like there's kind of this bi-directional relationship there. But there's probably some effect on it just regardless of the weight. And that's what people are saying. Their periods normalize when they go on it. And there's GLP-1 receptors everywhere, and there can be hormonal changes maybe from it. Really hard. There's a lot of research going on, so I use them for the indicated purposes. Meaning, if somebody's lean and has PCOS, I wouldn't necessarily give them the medicine. But if they have PCOS and obesity, sure. And then it improves. It seems to improve both. I think in the future, the research is going to be done where they will show that maybe these drugs can be indicated for reasons other than type 2 diabetes and weight. So think of the PCOS patient who doesn't have a lot of weight to lose, but just on a low dose, their symptoms improve and their quality of life improves. It may be reasonable to think about them there. It just needs to be researched more. I see it anecdotally, meaning like it hasn't been researched too much, but I get cases here and there that I'm like, okay. Other things like addiction, alcohol, abuse, other types of addiction, we're seeing a lot of stuff there. That one's definitely being studied. Other inflammation things, Alzheimer's disease, patients with autoimmune diseases are feeling just better taking these medicines. So there's some immunological modulation of some sort going on. And there's researchers looking at these various things, but they know things are happening, but it's just we're kind of in the infancy of understanding these other conditions. It's really cool to see.
Okay, awesome. Well, I appreciate the transparency in regards to saying that we're not more research is needed. This is kind of like
Yeah.
TLDR that I'm taking away from it. But nonetheless, it sounds promising. I do want to shift gears a little bit because I know you also have a podcast, or at least you're a co-host on a podcast called Doc who lifts. And so I assume that you are personally also invested in strength training. From what I know, strength training can help offset losing some of the muscle that's sometimes being lost when also using those GLP-1 agonizers or just weight loss drugs in general. Is that what you do use or try to use with your patients in order to combat that?
Yeah, I try every patient I have, I try to get them to do resistance training of some sort. Not everybody is willing to, but that's the goal. And that's probably the most important. Of course, optimizing protein can be beneficial too, but the resistance training is it would be the biggest bang for the buck. But so optimal protein and resistance training, ideally. And again, I'm specifically going to be studying this in my new clinic with like IRB approved studies and ideally randomized trials and things like that. But anecdotally, yeah, we like, you see in some of the studies, there is a little bit more we call lean mass loss. It's just, they don't know if it's muscle versus fluid or other things going on. But anecdotally, I don't see it in my patients. And, but again, they're when I see them, they're re resistance training and eating a lot of protein. So it's possible, I'm a selection bias clinic where, they're doing the things we'd recommend. Whereas if they go somewhere else and just get the medicine, maybe they are losing more. But it hasn't been, it needs to be studied more. But if I had to guess, I think we could minimize muscle loss with training. The other thing is like, it's possible. Who cares about the muscle loss as long as it's functioning better? So that's one of the thoughts is that the quality and the function of it is more important than just the overall amount of it. Now, as we're athletes and things like that, we care about the size too, like if we're physique competitors. But it may be different in those who are more sedentary, and they aren't even using their muscle in the first place. So then if they it looks like they lose some, but in fact they're able to do more and function better, I don't know. This is where people don't really know. They think that we need to preserve it better, which I think is good, but they're going to try to do using drugs to do that. And I think what they're going to run into, I think, is that I don't know if preserving that muscle without using it is as good as preserving it with using it. Maybe it's a good happy medium. I don't know. But that's my guess. And maybe I'm just biased because I like lifting weights. So whatever.
Yeah, I think I see what your point is though, because yeah, I mean, muscle that's not functional or that you don't know
Right.
how to use, like, yeah, there's still going to be some sort of physiological benefit perhaps, but still. So yeah, I guess speaking of the lifting and your own lifting journey, I could imagine that that has kind of evolved over the course of the decades, even since your medical studies and so on, also maybe adjusting to various life situations. What does your current lifting schedule and program look like versus maybe 10 or 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's now it's about sometimes two, but most of the times 3 times a week. It used to be more like 4 or 5 times a week. It used to be much more like I used to have like a back day, chest day, legs day, and maybe even sometimes an arm day. Now it's like upper body, lower body, upper body, lower body, and it's a lot more efficient now. I have kids and all this other stuff, so it's like, all right, I can't be spending all the time in here. And also, I have other stuff going on. So that's the biggest way it's changed. I still maintain a pretty good physique, not as big as what I used to be, maybe, but decent. But I also incorporate probably more aerobic training overall now, a few times a week. So it's instead of just I didn't do much at all. I never ran, never biked or anything, unless it was just recreational stuff or for wrestling, of course, wrestling practice, but like just for fun, going for runs and bikes. I didn't do that. So now I do that. So more for cardiovascular health purposes.
Gotcha. Okay, so more like longevity type of training, trying
Yeah.
to be somewhat well-rounded. And I
That's
mean,
right.
for anyone listening, the majority of listeners are going to be doing some sort of strength training or so. But those listening that perhaps are not active at the moment, what are some of the like overall benefits of having more muscle mass aside from aesthetic reasons?
Yeah, metabolically, if you think about it, you have more of a storage depot for both, glucose and fatty acids for use. So it think of it as like just another metabolic organ that you can actually use the energy you're taking in. It's a problem when you don't have a lot of muscle and you become insulin resistant to it. That's when your glucose and things go up and worsen. So if you have more muscle, and ideally if you use it more often too, you would have more of a place to actually use that substrate or lipids and glucose. So metabolically, it's pretty healthy. Now there gets to a point where it's probably too much is unhealthy. But let's just say you have a you're not under muscled and maybe you're slightly have more muscle than average. That's probably a good thing.
Okay, awesome. And I mean, apart from the metabolic benefits, what else is being positively impacted by having more
Yeah.
muscle?
Yeah, obviously it looks good, but the quality of life stuff is important. Like, think about being able to do more things. Think about, just stuff like carrying your groceries, carrying your kids. Like, I was at Disney a couple of years ago and I had to like carry my kids around Disney World and they drop things and you have to get down and pick it up. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't like lift weights. So I'm carrying both of them. It was miserable, but like, yeah, that stuff like that, but even so less stuff like carrying your groceries in, that type of thing. It's
Gotcha.
nice to have more strength and muscle to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that makes sense, and I can totally relate to that. And earlier you mentioned that aside from strength training, another quote unquote intervention with clients or patients or not could be to get them to focus on a higher protein diet. So how does that work, or why, like physiologically speaking, is that helping us?
Yeah, I mean, there's the having a little bit higher protein can have a muscle sparing effect when you're, losing weight and your calorie deficit type of thing. But again, it's a distant second compared to the resistance training, which sends the signal to your muscle to stick around type of thing that you need to use it. That's layman terms. I'm sure other scientists who get into the molecular signals would laugh about that, but. Yeah, the protein, eating a little bit more, a higher percentage of protein can have a small effect on muscle preservation. Again, I think the more important effect is using it, because there are some patients they this even though the DEXA scans do show a little bit higher than I would expect lean mass loss, fat-free mass, whatever you want to call it, but they're like able to deadlift now. Doing pull-ups and things like that. It's like, whereas before they weren't. So I'm like, I don't really care if they lost a little bit more. They're strong now. So with protein, if you're not lifting weights, you're just doing protein, like who cares if they have a little bit more muscle mass? I just want to make sure they're functioning better. So a lot of it comes back to using it.
Yeah, no, good point in terms of the muscle. I do think we often see that people are also just generally, I guess, more satiated with a bit more protein, or feeling more satiated, or maybe better blood sugar control overall, to help them also navigate their hunger a bit more or better naturally, aside from the drugs or any other interventions. But yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom with us, Spencer. This has been a super interesting conversation. I will make sure to link all your handles and of course also the link to your podcast in the show notes. But yeah, just want to thank you for your time and for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.